Hello, everybody. Welcome to Energy, Minerals, and the Environment. My name is John Bershaw. I am the professor teaching this class, and I have taught it for quite a few years now. This is a subject that I really enjoy. It's near and dear to my heart, partly because I'm just interested in the topic, but also I have some experience that makes this especially relevant for me and things that I think about, whether it's research or otherwise. And I'm going to talk about that a bit. So in this introductory video, I'm going to introduce myself and the class. And we're going to start out by going over the syllabus. So let's jump in. If you go onto Canvas, which hopefully most of the students in the class are familiar with, it's canvas.pdx.edu. You will end up finding the course, which is EES352U. And if you click on it, you might be presented with a screen that looks like this. It's the home screen, welcoming you to the course. So what I want to do is go into the syllabus, which is over here. You can also link to it down here in the description. I'm going to go to the syllabus. We'll talk about that. But also I want you to know that any material that you have to complete for this class is going to be housed within modules, this section here. Every week I'll post a module and give you the week to work through it, basically. And that module will include some video. It'll include some quizzes on the video. It could involve some reading. It may involve some discussion where you go online and participate in a discussion board, etc. So that's going to be kind of how the class is generally structured. But let's jump into the syllabus. So I'll click on syllabus here. And hopefully you can read this. If the text is too small in the video, feel free to go and access this on your own. But yeah, so the class is EES352U. This is a university studies course, sort of typically known as Junior Cluster, Energy, Minerals, and the Environment. It satisfies certain general education requirements, which I list down here, including ones in the Environmental Sustainability Cluster, the Global Environmental Change Cluster, and then the Natural Science Inquiry Cluster. And then also, you know, I sort of call this Economic Geology Light. I have quite a few geology students who like to take this just to learn about how minerals work, mining works, how it's sort of the economic side of geology works. So if you're interested in energy, which is such a huge topic, especially today, and it's not going to wane in importance anytime soon. If you're interested in energy, this class is for you. If you're interested in mining, you know, all the stuff that goes into everything that we use on a daily basis, whether it's electronic devices, whether it's vehicles that you're driving, et cetera, all of that is going to be related to material that is being extracted from the earth. And we're going to talk about, we don't have enough time to talk about everything, but I've sort of picked out certain types of ore and minerals that I think are especially interesting, partly because maybe they're mined in Oregon, or partly because I think that they're interesting to students in this class in terms of things that impact your life, like whether it's a device that you use or otherwise. And so we're going to talk about material that comes out of the earth, whether it's for energy, whether it's for minerals, providing all the technology that you see, etc. And we're going to talk about the environmental impacts of all of that as well. You know, there's a lot of environmental impacts, not just in terms of the physical environment, but let's say the cultural environment in terms of society. You know, how does extraction of materials impact society, whether it's providing jobs, whether it's you know, people going onto other folks' land and taking resources out, and then the people who own that land or have existed on that land for a long time not receiving any benefit. I mean, there's all sorts of political implications here and dimensions to resource extraction, which we'll be touching on as well. So lots of material to cover. Hopefully there's something in here for everybody. And again, I think hopefully an interesting class. So let's jump into the syllabus. We have some information about myself here. John Bershaw is my name. I mentioned that. My phone number is my work number. You're free to call. I have my email address. This is my office, Kramer Hall 17, Office G. It's within the geology unit within the School of Earth, Environment, and Society. And I have drop-in and Zoom hours on Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. That's just a weekly time that you can come and talk with me, whether it's on Zoom or in person. I'll be doing it from my office. If you'd like to meet with me outside of that time, I'm happy to do so, whether it's just for a quick chat on Zoom, whether it's in person, etc. I am available. I also have a teaching assistant who's going to be helping with this class, so you'll have multiple sort of points of contact of people that can help out with material. I include a Zoom link here. This is basically my work Zoom link, and that's what we'll be using for those office hours. I created a Discord group, and this has been useful for some folks. You know, some people are already on Discord, others aren't, and find out about it and then use it. It's basically just a chatting tool. It's a software program that facilitates chatting. And so I created a channel for the class there, and this is a permanent invite if you'd like to join that channel. I know just some number of students join this. There's no requirement to do so. It's only if you want to connect with other classmates in this kind of more informal environment. People can ask questions about homework or just post things that you find related to the class that you want to share with people, etc. And I'm also in there sort of monitoring it. So if you have questions for me, you're free to post them there. In addition to emailing me, I will also respond. Okay, we have two texts that are useful in this class but not required to purchase. But they are useful. And the first one here, Mineral Resources, Economics, and the Environment by Kessler and Simon. That is on reserve at the PSU Library. And a lot of material will be coming from that. I will provide reading when necessary, so you don't have to purchase it. But again, if this is an interesting class to you, I'd encourage you to go check it out. Find a used version, find an older edition, whatnot. I mean, this type of material, I think, benefits a lot from the most recent edition because the landscape around energy and mineral usage changes so quickly that I would encourage folks to maybe focus on getting a more recent edition. Even though the fundamentals of the geology and the science behind how we extract this material stays a little bit more consistent, I'd say the politics around it and how these things affect society and the environment changes pretty quickly. But regardless, those are the books. Overarching goals of the class, we're going to understand energy and the potential impact of human activity, characterize key minerals, looking at these things globally, environmental impacts, and also we're going to do some quantitative analysis, so looking at numbers regarding energy generation efficiency, environmental impacts, and also relate that to our own usage of whether it's a cell phone device, for example, or driving cars or heating a home or whatever it is that we do to exist, hopefully relatively comfortably on this planet. Ancillary goals, you will consider energy generation in your own life. Be able to express an idea in a well-structured, coherent paragraph. So this is kind of leading into the goals right beyond this, which is related to this being a general education course, or at least fulfilling certain requirements there. You're going to do some writing, in other words, and you're also going to take some data sets, and you're going to analyze those a bit. There's no prerequisites for this class, okay? So I'm going into this assuming that everything you know is kind of at a general college level, and I'm not going to require you to know any fancy math or otherwise in order to complete activities. Okay, if there's anything that you need to know that's beyond just sort of general college level knowledge, I will provide it to you. So we will do some writing, we will do some data analysis, and we will hopefully understand how our own usage of devices impacts energy and the environment, etc. Okay, so I already mentioned this is part of these clusters here, the grading policy. Let's jump into that. It's an online class without scheduled meeting times. That's asynchronous. You are expected to watch all the videos, complete all assignments. Assignments and quizzes will be discounted 5% per day late to a maximum of 40% off. So, in other words, if you turn in something late, which I encourage people to turn everything in, period. Okay, the thing that hurts people's grades the most is just not completing assignments, not turning things in. So ideally turn things in on time by the due date, But if you can't get it in on time for whatever reason, turning it in is going to still be really important to do for your grade. So every day that you turn in something late, I will reduce your grade by 5%, up to a maximum of 40% off. So if you turn something in, let's say this first week's assignment, okay, we got 10 weeks in the class. The first week's assignment, you don't turn that assignment in until the last day of class, which is like in mid-March or early mid-March. I will still give you, and let's say you do a perfect job, okay? You absolutely knock it out of the park. I will still give you 60% on that assignment, which is so much better than 0%. 60% is huge compared to zero. So once again, please turn everything in, even if you turn it in late. Also, understand life gets in the way sometimes. So if something arises, an emergency that was unanticipated, you need more time to complete something or some other accommodation, let me know. Reach out. I know that things happen, okay? So please just feel free to communicate. But if you are going to turn in something late and want full credit, you do need to communicate to me ideally beforehand. Let me know what's going on as soon as possible. Not the last day of class, right? In terms of the grade breakdown, 35% of the grade will be related to weekly quizzes given on Canvas. Everything's pretty much happening in Canvas. There are two exams, a midterm and a final. They are open book, and those are going to be 20% of your grade total, so 10% each. Assignments, 20% of your grade, and those are given periodically. A lot of these are that part of the grade consists of contributing to the online discussions. And then there's an energy project, which is pretty big, 25%. This is the written piece, and you're going to learn about your own energy and resource usage. You're going to pick a device, and you're going to talk about that. And it's sort of multiple parts, okay, four different parts to this. And in total, that'll be 25% of your grade. So that's the writing. Okay, some more general things here. Behavior, basically be respectful, folks. Treat your fellow classmates, whether it's online or otherwise, in office hours, etc., with respect. Derogatory, harassing language is not acceptable, whether it's shared with the entire class or an individual. That includes myself. And I will strive to model this as well. Be respectful of you all as my students and use respectful language, etc. Artificial intelligence. This is fun. This is part of life at this point for most people. Not everybody's sort of has gone into the AI realm quite yet, but I think most people have, and we have tools available to us across the board, whether Gemini, ChatGPT, etc. I don't have like a ban on using AI or anything. I'm fine with people using it to augment your learning process. This is the key. Brainstorming, refining your drafts and your writing, etc. But here's some good rules to think about. Number one, attribution. Okay, you need to just be transparent in your usage. And that's the next point here. Cite any AI-generated text or data used in your work. This includes in-text citations for direct quotes, clear references to data that's discussed or presented. So if you're finding information through some chatbot that you're using, you need to basically be citing that information and letting me know how you're getting that. And that includes, this is best practice, right? You get some data, it comes from somewhere. You need to follow the breadcrumb trail there and figure out, is that data real, right? And where is that data coming from? Because a chatbot AI is not ideally fabricating it. If it is, then we need to not be using it, right? So you need to find the source of that data and provide that source and let me know basically that you're using it. So here's the transparency piece. Beyond simple grammar checking, please disclose in a brief AI use statement at the end of an assignment explaining how it was used. Again, it's fine. I'm fine with people using AI. Just be transparent about it. And here's an example. AI was used to generate an initial online search, which I then expanded. So yeah, just sort of letting people know that it is being used. Accountability. You are 100% responsible for the accuracy of any assignment submissions. whether you use AI or anything else. Okay, so, you know, people know this at this point, hallucinations are real in the AI world. So any errors that are generated that you then submit as part of an assignment, you are responsible for. Okay, so it's all about double checking that and making sure that whatever you're presenting is accurate. Misconduct generating entire assignments through AI or failing to attribute AI-assisted content constitutes academic dishonesty. Do not do that. It would be very similar to if you reference other people's work and copy that work, present it as your own. You can't do that. That is academic dishonesty. On the other hand, presenting other people's work, which is generally what we do when we write these papers, right? You're drawing from the body of knowledge out there and then citing where that information comes from. That is the difference. That is all that's needed to be done. The fine line, if you will, between plagiarism and rigorous, you know, ethical scientific writing, you know, basically citing where your information's coming from, giving proper attribution. So my goal is for you to learn to use these tools ethically and effectively as learning aids, not as substitutes for your own critical thinking. And that is really the key. Ask yourself, is this helping me learn or is this replacing my learning? Okay, because we are here to learn. That's why we enroll in school, in college, university, etc. Okay, I have some other pieces here included that are important to know about. I'm not going to go into them in detail, but there's a sexual harassment discrimination policy with good resources there, access and inclusion for students with disabilities. Also very important, I have students every single term in all of my classes that use the DRC. And I know it provides a lot of really helpful resources. So if you're interested in doing that, if it's going to be helpful to you, I encourage you to do so. Additional resources here, which just links to different things, whether it's related to financial insecurity, food insecurity, and then various resources are also listed. And then I also have a link to the Student Code of Conduct down here, which is basically housed in the Dean of Student Life. Okay, so that is the syllabus. Let's jump into the slideshow, which I was just on for a moment. So this is the initial slide. And all I'm going to do in the rest of this introduction is basically talk a little bit about myself and who am I? What is my background? Why am I qualified, so to speak, to teach this class? And we have in the background here, this is Butte, Montana, which many of you may not know. And there is a very large open pit mine, no longer active. You're going to be learning about this in the following lecture, so I'll save that for a moment. But just to sort of follow up on the syllabus and then transition into my own introduction, I have some just general points here that I think are important. Number one, science knowledge does not equal the quality of an individual. So in other words, I'm not going to judge you in terms of your value as a human being in relation to how well you do in this class. Okay, if you do poorly in this class, I'm still going to respect you as a human being. If you do great in this class, I'm going to respect you and I'm going to be very happy for you as well. But just know that I respect you as a person, as a human being, above and beyond, first and foremost, before anything else. And also remember, we're all ignorant just about different things. So I have a background that allows me to teach this class, but I don't know about all of the things that most of the students in this class are learning about, because most people are not geology majors taking this. And I'm always learning from my students and understanding that, hey, if we don't know about something, then that's an opportunity. And we're in a learning environment here. And so if you don't know about something, fantastic, let's learn about it. I will not berate you for not knowing something. It is, as I just mentioned, an opportunity. That's basically my philosophy of teaching and learning. That's the kind of environment I want to create in my classes, whether online like this one or otherwise. Okay, so my background, this is kind of a collage of various places I've lived in my life. So I actually grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I was born in Seattle, but basically went to middle school, high school, etc. here in Portland. When I graduated high school, I went down to Los Angeles, and this is kind of what it looked like when I was there. All this smog. I think that actually a lot of it's been cleaned up. I was there in college in the 90s, went to Pomona College, got a bachelor's degree in geology, was exposed to the desert, the Mojave Desert, which is very different, obviously, from the Pacific Northwest, but beautiful. And got me into studying rocks. I eventually went to graduate school in the in Rochester, New York, which is in Western New York State, in the Northeast. And that's what this photo's from. This is, you know, it's well known for getting lake effect snow, and they have this fleet of little what are these things? little shovel. Bulldozers that shovel the sidewalks. It's sort of relatively thin. This is how on top of snow they are. As soon as it snows, they're out there plowing snowplows, plowing the sidewalks in addition to the streets, etc. So yeah, I did my graduate work and got a PhD in geoscience at the University of Rochester in Western New York. After graduating, I moved to Houston, Texas, which is in the middle here, which is prone to flooding, particularly during hurricanes, which have come through there on occasion. And what was I doing in Houston? Well, I went to work for the oil industry. I was working at Chevron, and I worked there for a number of years. Various oil fields throughout the world. It's an international company, even though it's based here in the United States. Actually, their corporate is in California. But I worked offshore Gulf of Mexico, deepwater Gulf of Mexico, where a lot of drilling happens. I worked Southern California, one of the oldest oil fields in the United States, near Bakersfield, California, which is shown here. I worked Iraqi Kurdistan. I worked Baffin Bay, West Greenland. So many areas throughout the world. Again, that was in the oil industry, that is Chevron likes to call it, the energy industry. Then at some point after that, I came back to the Pacific Northwest and got this job as a geology professor here at Portland State University. But that time in the energy industry really sort of tuned me into, you know, both the geology side of how we go about extracting, in particular, hydrocarbons. In this case, the environmental side. I went down there and started working basically right after the Macondo oil spill. So drilling in the Gulf of Mexico was on moratorium at the time that I started working in oil. And just seeing kind of the political and environmental side of it was really a learning opportunity for me as well. So I had some interesting experiences that I hope to be able to share during this class. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my research too, which dovetails in there. So research-wise, I study many things, but one of the areas that I've been focused on for a long time is climate and what we call tectonics, which is mountains and high plateau, high topography. And this image here, I've studied this in different parts of the world, including Asia, including South America. This image here, I think, shows this relationship really well. And it's something we see in the Pacific Northwest really starkly, in addition to in South America. So you have all this green here. This is the Amazon Basin, right? It's very tropical, gets a lot of precipitation. And then you move up onto what this is the Andean Plateau. Okay, so this is the Andes Mountain Range, which runs along the west side of South America here. The Andean Plateau is just a very high elevation plateau on the west side here, right in this bend in South America. And it's super dry, which you can tell from this satellite image, right? It's brown as opposed to green. Why is it dry? Well, it's high elevation. So air masses come from the northeast and they rain out on the subandes, which is sort of the eastern side of the topography here. And by the time that air mass reaches the high topography, it's basically been wringed out of all of its moisture or most of its moisture, and you go into a rain shadow, which is what's shown here on the left. This is precipitation amount in locations right throughout South America here. So the red is very scant precipitation, and that's shown for the Andean Plateau. We see the same thing in Oregon. When you go from the Willamette Valley and then you head east over the Cascade Mountains, you go into the rain shadow of the mountains. And so one of the things I've studied a lot is that interaction between climate and topography through geologic time, going back in time, millions of years, to understand well, when did these mountains form? And when the mountains form, you would expect that you're also going to get that climate gradient, right? The rain shadow is going to be created, which is reflected in things like fossil teeth. And that's what's shown here. I have two ancient fossil teeth from beasts that existed in South America that I collected from the Andean Plateau. These are now extinct mammals. They're called notoungulates. And basically, you can see in the teeth here, this is a molar. There's all these little striations that I've drilled here with a dental drill. And I'm basically extracting powder from the molar as it grows over time. And I'm looking at the chemistry of that. That's the carbon and oxygen isotopic composition. By looking at the composition of these isotopes and how they change through time, you can say something about the climate. It reflects the water in the environment, which is reflective of the climate. And so by looking at the climate through time, I'm able to say something about the evolution of the mountains. Like, when did the rain shadow form? Oh, did it go from being wet to dry at some point? And if it went from wet to dry, is that because maybe a mountain range formed, like the Andean Plateau, that then became really dry? And so that's kind of how it all ultimately ties together. I've done the same thing for Oregon, looking at volcanic glass, paleosol carbonates, which are ancient soils, using these same techniques to try to constrain or understand the timing of the formation of the Cascade Range. We have this beautiful mountain range to the east of us. When did that form? Well, we can go to the east of it and say, well, when did the rain shadow develop? Because the rain shadow is a function of that mountain range. And so I can look at rocks in eastern Oregon going back over time and see, well, what did the climate look like? What did the paleoclimate look like through time? And start to make those conclusions or statements. Okay, another area that I focused on is energy, but in our backyard. So this is not oil related, right? Related to sort of my past life, but this is more related to research that I do at Portland State University around geothermal energy. So I'm really interested in geothermal. I've done multiple projects, including this one here, which included a lot of different partners, the U.S. Geological Survey, which is the USGS for short, Oregon Health Science University, Alta Rock, which is a geothermal exploration company, City of Portland, et cetera. We're all involved in this particular study, which was looking at, it's a fancy title here, the Integrated Feasibility Study of Reservoir Thermal Energy Storage, RTES, in Portland, Oregon, USA. So what is RTES, Reservoir Thermal Energy Storage? Basically, what we can do is think about geothermal as accessing the Earth's heat. And this is a heat map, basically, of the United States. How much heat is being produced and coming out at the surface? So at any point on the surface of the Earth, you have an amount of heat that is radiating out from the center of the Earth. And you can see on the right here, it's listed in milliwatts per meter squared. Okay, there's certain parts where a lot of heat's coming out and other parts where not as much. And places where a lot of heat's coming out, we call that a very high geothermal gradient. And in the western U.S., throughout Nevada, parts of Oregon here, Idaho, this real pink spot here, does anybody know what that is? This little pink dot here, it's in northwestern Wyoming. That would be Yellowstone. It's the Yellowstone hotspot. So a lot of heat basically conducting through the Earth's crust in that location. But regardless, we have a lot of heat in the western U.S. Portland is located here. Notice the Willamette Valley and the Coast Range is actually very low in terms of heat flow. And so what you can do in conventional geothermal is you can go to a place where it's hot. Nevada's done this quite a bit. California's done this over here. And you can drill a well and basically circulate water and heat that water up and then use that water to generate electricity. You can use that water as a direct use application just to, heat buildings, for example, all sorts of different things. That's conventional geothermal. In our case, what we are proposing, this is a research project. We're like, let's do something unconventional. In Portland, where we don't necessarily have a really high geothermal gradient, you got to go over to the mountains for that, to the Cascades, to the volcanoes. But in the valley, it's a lot lower, the geothermal gradient is. We're going to propose that for critical infrastructure, a place like a hospital, we're going to circulate fluids in the subsurface. We're in a basin. The Portland Basin has a bunch of sedimentary rock underneath us, and that rock is porous and permeable, so you can actually move fluid through it. And our proposal was to heat water at the surface during the summer, and this could be through direct use solar panels on top of a building, for example, and then inject that warm water into the subsurface during the summer when we're heating it, and then in the wintertime, flip the circulation direction and produce or bring that hot water back out and use it in a direct use capacity to heat the building, for example. This isn't going to be hot enough water to generate electricity, but you can use it in a direct use application for heating. And so that was what we were looking at, and we basically did a bunch of modeling. We had to look and see what is the geology of the sedimentary basin, you know, where would we be putting this and circulating this fluid, how much heat can we pull out, etc. That was the project. And we came up with some feasibility numbers in terms of the costs, etc., which were really interesting. I mean, basically, it was what we found and suggested is that it's competitive with other forms of heating, even though the initial capital costs are pretty high, because anytime you're drilling a well, you're going to be spending some money. But over the life cycle of a system, the costs end up being competitive with other sources of energy. And this is something that's actually been done in other parts of the world, including in Scandinavia and in some other places like in Germany. It just hasn't really been done much in the United States yet. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up there a little bit about myself. Look out for the next video in which we're going to talk about Butte, Montana. So we're going to jump right into looking at mineral extraction and all the different facets that go along with that, including the economics, the environmental impacts, etc. Thank you.